Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 14, delivered on October 5, 2017. The title of this lecture is Bond Characteristics.
Today, Bond Characteristics. Start out with a something about interest rates. Usually in finance, we'll just say there is an APR. An interest rate. But actually, interest rates that we see are a composite of shorter term rates. So, for example, I could say, well, the 2-year APR is, let's say 4.25%. And that's what I'll usually do in a class, yeah. Or a loan is for 20 years and it's got an APR. That interest rate is there the whole time. But an interest rate like this is actually a composite. Now, you can break it down into as short a period as you want. But suppose that the 1-year actual rate is, let's say, 4.05%. And then there's actually another rate that's carrying from year 1 to year 2. There's another rate, let's say, on the 1 to 2 year, there's a rate of 4.38%. Then the actual composite rate, the actual rate that's happening, I got to be careful not to say real rate, is 1 + 0.0405 times 1.0438 minus 1. That's the actual rate that's going on. That second rate there, by the way, the first rate you see is called a spot rate. That's your shortest rate that would be some. You could even have a 6-month spot, a 4-month, a 1-month, and you could do all kinds of long chain calculations to get 1 year, 5 year, whatever. We usually break it down to either 6 month or a year. But anyway, that's a spot rate right there. That 1 year, from 0 to 1 for the first year. This guy right here, this 1 to 2 year rate, that's called a forward rate. And oftentimes what we try to do is we'll see a rate on, let's say, a 10-year, the yield to maturity on a 10-year bond. We'll do that. But then what we'll do is we'll try to peel off the onion and look at the structure of the spot and the forwards that created that yield to maturity that we're seeing there. That can tell us a lot. Let me do this one real quick here for you, just to show you how this goes in action. I'm going to clear this, and I'm going to go 1.05 times 438. Minus 1. I was just testing you there on that one. There it is. I want to put it right there. Okay, and insert a times sign. You know what? I'm just going to type it back in. This keyboard has got me. I can't use the number pad except for times. I have to use the number pad for times. Times 1.0438 minus 1. You know, I'm going to quit here in a little while. I am so confused because I can't use the number pad for the numbers, but I can't, but I have to use the number pad for the algebraic signs. One. I thought that was it. It's not. I don't know. That was my immediate, it had to be that. No, something is really 1405 times, 1.0438. Then I have to go back over here, minus, and back over here. Okay. Now, the point I'm trying to get to here is this. Suppose that I, and one way we can do this, by the way, one way we can do this is we can look at the spot rate is always going to be in our face. There's going to be a one-year spot. We can know that. But then we can see a two-year composite rate. And what we do is divide back out the first year, and then we can see the second year. Let me show you one where I would do that. So, for example, a one-year T-bill is going off at spot 2.35%. Now, I look at a two-year T-bill. I look at a two-year T-bill, and that's going off at a spot of, let's say, 2.50%. Now, clearly the market is saying that interest rates look like they're going to be higher on the longer as time goes on. I want to make sure you see that. That there's obviously a market sentiment that the spot for one-year investment, we should earn about 2.35%. For a two-year, we should earn about 2.50%. So the market is telling us that interest rates a year out are going to be rising over what they are within this year. But it's a little more dramatic than that. Because what I could do is I could, and here's how you do it. Here's how you do it. And there are a couple of problems, and I'm showing you this. Don't get confused. It's actually not that hard. But here's one where I would take, 1 plus 0.0235 squared over 1 plus 0.0250 and then minus 1. You would square the spot and then divide it by the second years. Why square? Because it's 2 years. We're saying, the spot rise for 2 years compounded, and then let's divide off that second year to see what really the second forward rate is. And if I can actually make this calculator do what I am ordering it to, I would do 1.0235, and then I'm going to take that to the second power. And then I'm going to divide that by 1.50. And then I'm going to minus 1. Now I think that negative sign is... look at that. I did it again. I've had it. I mean... No math in this class for the rest of the semester. Did I do that? Squared divided by 1.0250 minus 1. You know what? One more time, and then there's no math for the rest of the semester. Hat 2 divided by 1.0250. 0.0250. And I'll say, calculate that, thank you. And then minus 1. There we go. So the actual forward rate that's coming out of this is 2.20%. The point here being that when we look at just a composite rate like this, it doesn't tell us as much as if we look at the spot and each of the forwards that created a multi-year composite rate. In that way, we are looking more at year-to-year investor expectations. Instead of looking at an overall expectation, what we can do is then finally divide how the market is thinking about the year-to-year future. So it's one thing to talk about what's going to have your overall success in over 10 years. But it's another thing to talk about for planning purposes what is going to happen, what we expect to happen in each year. I can tell you all that for the most part, in 20 years, you'll be making well over $100,000 a year. Right. But along the way, it would be nice if you knew how that's going to happen year to year for planning purposes. In year 5, you might get fired, end up on the street, a homeless man, grunting at people walking by. You, madam, may be taken up in year 8 by an alien mothership, and they make you queen of the universe. And then you finally say, no, I want to use that training I learned in Professor C's class. I need to go back. So you hijack the starship and you fight your way back through the Mulgan defense lines. And then you do a couple of really cool things. You take on a rebel army and you fight off. Okay. Anyway, you know what I mean. In markets, we can look at the overall. That's the APR or whatever. But when we can chop that up and look at what's going on year to year, then we have more of what the market thinks is going to be going on. Now, I tell you right now, I did a calculation just on the back of the envelope, and I forgot to bring my envelope. Literally, it was an envelope. And I was looking at the forward rate structure on Treasury instruments. And it was interesting that the Treasuries, there's definitely an arch on the yield curve. But if you take, in other words, the 2-year, 5-year, 7-year, those are going up. But if you actually tease out the forward structure year by year of those, they're really going up. I mean, they are going up a lot. So even though the 5-year rate may be about 200 basis points above the 1-year rate, when you look at the forward structure of that, my heavens, that it is really arching upwards. So apparently, behind the curtain, the market is thinking that there's going to have to be a dramatic rise, a really dramatic rise in interest rates over the next 5 years. Probably to fight inflation, the Fed's going to be fighting inflation. Somewhat, the budget deficits are going to go crazy, which we don't know whether they are or not, but there's an expectation of it. And also, there's a sense that there's going to be more and more budget deficits and cost at the state and local level, cleaning up infrastructure, rebuilding, making America great again, and all that. So apparently the markets seem to think that there's going to be a pretty steep upward push on interest rates over the next 5 years. Actually, I went out 10 years, and it seems to tail off from 7 to 10. The forward rate on 7 to 10 is not as bad. And just to remind you, if you know, the 6-month rate is let's say, 4.6%, then the one-year rate would be 1 plus 0.046 to the second power. 1/2 a year. Remember, 1/1 the number of years. So in this case, what it would be is 1/2 a year. Remember, it's always 1/1 the number of years. That's why that is a power 2, is because it's 1/2 year. And minus 1. So in other words, in this case, your actual annual rate on this thing would be 1.046 to the second power minus 1. If I just stick with the math. So in other words, the actual annual rate is 9.41%. It's 9.41%. Just don't ever forget, if it's not the best strategy, and this is the one that I use, the book shows you a couple of other ways, but what I always do is I turn everything into an annual rate. They might say, well, it's a six-month rate, and then we're going to do monthly. Well, what my reaction is, I take it out and turn it into an annual rate, and then work from there to a monthly rate. Just it's a gut reaction, old school, make everything an annual, and then chop it back up after you've made it annual. Otherwise, I mean, you know, if they give you a six-month rate, you could just take it to the 1/6th power to get a one-month rate. And so my way of doing it is a little bit longer. It's an old habit. But like I said, it doesn't hurt to turn things into an annual and then back them down. And be careful about rounding. I mean, you're doing exponents and reciprocal exponents, and so every time you round, it just magnifies terribly. Now, I'm going to take you away from this part, and I'm going to go get the math off the board here for a while. It kind of gets tedious rather quickly. And I'm going to talk to you about characteristics of bonds in terms of what kinds of animals are out there. And again, I'm going to do a quick, dirty one on the board for you here to make sure that you understand. Oh, ALC, and we'll do 5.25%. And let's say this one's at 2036 right now. It's at 2036. So again, the trading symbol of the company is ALC. We could look it up and see its name, but we really don't care. The coupon is 5.25%, which means that it is going to pay an annual coupon of $52.50. Just immediately when you see that coupon, turn it into a dollar amount. That'll help you avoid the confusion of coupon and yield. Just turn it into a dollar amount. Right away, I know that that is a $52.50 per year coupon. And the 2036, that's its time of maturity. That means that the term of this bond, is 17, 27 is 10, 37 is 20, 19 years. The term is 19 years. And actually the term is what really matters for your calculations. Again, maturity stays the same, term reduces. And as the term approaches zero, well, we know some interesting things, characteristics of the bond. Now, let's go both ways. I'm going to take you both ways just so you have it in your notes again to make sure you've got it. And then I'm going to say a few things that would really be helpful to you for the exam, as a matter of fact. First things first. Let's say that the yield to maturity is 5.42%. Find the price. Now, interestingly enough, this is not how it would really be. We'd know the price and we'd find the yield, the yield to maturity. But find the price on this thing. Now, I was trying to have about an hour and a half to watch a half-decent Netflix movie, and I kept getting beaten up with questions on email, which was okay because the movie was kind of lame. But anyway, watch. Again, unless otherwise stated, we assume that the coupons are paid. One more time. We assume that the coupons are paid. I love it when you talk dirty like that. Yes. Semi-annual. So in other words, there are not going to be 19 payments. There are going to be 19, times two payments. Yes. Yes, indeed. Now, if that is the case, then the yield to maturity is 5.42 divided by 2 to make it a semi-annual yield. And then we are looking for the price value, so we leave that alone. We know the payments are $52.50 a year divided into 2 installments every year. And finally, we always... it's a classic kind of question. The future value is $1,000. And then we can just roll on up, make sure this is on end. And then we just roll on up and we say, Alpha, solve this puppy. The price is $979.99. And that is a dollar amount. I asked for the price, not the quote. One way you can tell that you're on the right track here is that the market says this bond should pay 5.42%. The bond pays less than that, 5.25%. Therefore, this bond will sell at a discount to par. The market will punish this bond. Investors will sell off this bond because it doesn't give them as much as it should. That will drive the price down below par. That's all there is to it. And now, suppose that we took it back the other way. The price of this bond is equal to $1,028.16. In this case, now we would ask to find the yield to maturity. And I'm just giving you more examples. This will make it easy for you on the quiz, and it will also help you when I talk in just a minute about my expectation of how you would answer things on a test. Okay, everything is about this bond is the same, except that now we are going to put in the price, which is $1,028.16. Notice how I'm saving myself all those mistakes because now I'm just keying in instead of trying to use the keyboard like I should. Okay, don't ever forget, PVs are negatives. And now I'm going to go back up here to the I percent and alpha solve it. But don't forget, for heaven's sake, please don't forget that with semi-annual, when you solve for the interest rate, the yield, you have to times that by 2. It just kills me when I see students, they've got it right, that they just saw that number and they forgot to multiply by 2. So it's 5.02% rounded to two decimal places. And that should make sense to you. That should make sense to you. Simply because this bond is clearly selling at a premium to par, so the market thinks that that coupon of 5.25% is a little too rich. So investors are going to like it. Oh, that's a good coupon compared to what it should be. So bond buyers are going to enter, demand will go up, the price will slip above par. Now, of course, if the bond and the yield are the same, put this down for God's sake. If the coupon and the yield are the same, then the bond will sell at par. If coupon equals yield to maturity, bond sells at par. If the coupon is better than the yield, then the bond will sell at a premium. I wrote this down the last lecture, I know, but I'm emphasizing. Now, if the coupon is less than the yield, then the bond will sell, this marker is about had it, at a discount to par. To par. And I should write that up there, put that to par. Okay, now,
get this in your notes. It's a classic for an exam. What I'm going to say is this. As the spread between yield, coupon and yield increases, the bond's price gets further away from par. As the spread between coupon and yield increases, the bond's price gets further from par. Now, put it the other way. As the spread between coupon and yield decreases, the bond's price approaches par. Again, as the spread between coupon and yield decreases, the bond's price approaches par. Be careful on an exam because you can lose a lot of points with an answer. If I were to ask, and this is one way I could ask, what happens to a bond price as the spread between coupon and yield decreases? An answer is, I've seen it too many times, well, the bond price is at a premium, or the bond price is at a discount. That's not a correct answer. That loses all the points. You have to show me that, well, yeah, coupon and yield, it depends on which way it's which side the spread is happening on. But if all I'm asking is what happens to the price as the spread narrows, well, that's just, well, I don't know which way it's narrowing from above or below, but I do know that it is getting closer to par. Now, there's another part to this that could be a question. And these are actually very quick answers. If you've got it down in your gut, clearly, these are straightforward. I'm going to do another thing here. Let me take Let me just do this bond right here.
Let me do this bond right here. Let's take this bond, and let's say that the yield to maturity on it is, about 5.45%. Watch. And this is important. This is a question I could give you on the exam. I'm trying to telegraph some punches to you here. So let's do this bond again. Everything should be about the same. Now, this bond's term, it is now 2017. In 2017, term is 19 years. So let's look at the yield to maturity. I'm sorry, let's look at the price. The price. Now, obviously, well, not obviously yet to you, but because the market is saying this bond should pay 5.45%, the coupon isn't good enough, so it's going to sell at something of a discount to par. So we've got the 19 times 2, no problem with that, times 2. Now we're going to take it down here, and we're going to say, all right, the yield to maturity we're saying is 5.45%, so we'll take 5.45 divided by 2. And we're going to look at the payments. Everything else is the same. No big thing. So let's look at the price value. Alpha solve. 976.51 is the price. 976.51. Okay. Now let's say we go forward in time. Let's take this bond out. Suppose that now we are sitting in, let's do 2025. So in 2025, the term is 11 years. All we have to do is go up back up to the top and now change this to 11 times 2 and go down and get the price. $983.62. All right. Now let's take it in 2032. The term at this point is only 4 years. One more time. If I go back up here and I do 4 times 2 and go back down and get the price, alpha solve on the present value, 992.90. Okay, now, let's do it. Draw your conclusion. What's happening to the price as the term approaches zero? What's happening? Perfect. Perfect. That's always going to happen. I mean, and it wouldn't matter. It would be, if this were at a premium, it would do the same thing. All bonds, if they're healthy bonds, I mean, if it's a bond that's going to die, it's probably going to head to zero. But in a normal circumstance, it always, bonds, even if there's a really big spread between coupon and yield, they all come toward par simply because there's less time for those coupon payments to matter. 10 minutes before the bond matures, you're going to get your $1,000. So the coupons, the impact of interest rates on the final delivery becomes less and less important as the term of the bond approaches zero. So it becomes more and more like a guaranteed payment of $1,000. Even if the coupon is insanely great compared to the yield, as the thing approaches zero, it's going to pay $1,000. That was what was funny about those. I mentioned in an earlier lecture, back when interest rates went crazy in the early 1980s, companies were issuing bonds that had coupons that were like the dream ticket, like 25% coupons.
And, of course, once interest rates settled down, those things were really, really valuable. The premium on, you mean I could actually buy a bond that has a coupon of 25%? When interest rates were normal in the 90s, those things were selling at insane premiums to par. It was kind of sad, though, because all of those old corporate long bonds were maturing in the around 2010, 2011, 2012. And even though the coupons were ridiculously high, naturally the bonds were settling toward par because it was the term was approaching zero. There wasn't anything left by that time except for waiting for your final $1,000 to show up in the a check. So even those ones with ridiculously high coupons, they died kind of the death of all bonds. They just sort of settled into par. Now, so in other words, as the term approaches zero, the bond price will approach par. That's all there is to it. I've given you an example of approaching par from below, but the general principle is it doesn't matter whether the bond is at a premium to par or a discount to par. They will all approach par. The only exception to that is bonds that are in companies that are dying. In a company like that, the bond might approach zero if there's nothing in the company. It might approach that bond's liquidation value. Like that bond, everyone's figuring, well, that bond will probably get about $200 in liquidation. So the bond's price, that's the unusual thing. When the company is dying, as the bond approaches its maturity date, it's certainly not going to approach par. It'll approach zero or the liquidation value of that bond's claim. Don't worry about that. If I ask it on an exam, you don't need to go into that detail. Well, for dying companies, it would be. So like, for example, Sears bonds approaching their maturity date, they're not approaching zero. They're approaching, I can't remember what it is. It's some like $200, $300, something like that. So in other words, when those bonds mature, those claimants, the people who have those bonds, have the prior claim on the assets. The market's figuring, that's probably going to be worth about $200. Like I mentioned in the last lecture, there is some play in speculation. If I can buy a Sears bond that's going to mature in a year, if I can buy that bond for like $150, I might figure that when that thing matures, Sears being liquidated and sold off, maybe I could get like $200, $250 in liquidation on that bond claim. You never know, though. It's a speculative play, and I do know some investors who do those kinds of very high-risk kinds of claim. What could be the disaster, though, is if you bought one of those bonds, and when they liquidate Sears, if it's going to be liquidated. No, Sears, don't bitch at me. I don't know if you're going. If they liquidate it and you find out that there's hardly any value at all in the liquidation, that would be a disaster because you pay $200, and it turns out there's hardly anything for the bondholders to have at the end. The liquidation value is terrible on it. But things like that are part of it. Now, a little bit more about bonds internally. Go ahead. No. You are all, see, that's the thing is that they would liquidate. And then they would look at the bondholders, all of the people who are owed debt. And they would figure out who has the big claims, like senior mortgage debt that's actually backed by buildings. They'd get, those buildings would be liquidated, and they would get in proportion to their bond holdings from those buildings. Other things would be liquidated all over the place, and then they would look at the order of claim of the bondholders. You might be a senior subordinated. That would mean that the seniors had to be made completely whole before you got anything. But if they were and there were money left, you would get as much as there was. Now, suppose that you're a junior bondholder. If he is completely made whole and he is completely made whole, then whatever's left could go to you in order of claim. And that's how it works. It's just like priority. The highest claim within the debt holders are the mortgage bond holders,
because they're the ones who actually, theirs is attached to like building or something like that, or to a factory or to the truck fleet or something like that. Those are the ones that's liquidated and they are taken care of to the extent that they can. And then everything else is liquidated, and usually those mortgage holders are then made whole from that. And then the lower claims and the lower claims. And you can get, and that was one of the things that I was bringing up. I'm glad you brought this up, because in terms of bonds, the highest one are the senior bonds. And then there's the senior subordinated. And then there's the junior. And then there's the junior subordinated. Now, obviously, well, maybe not obviously, what happens is that the coupons are better the farther you go down the line, because there's more risk down here than there is up here. Now, one way that you can divide up bonds, there are a lot of different ways. I'm going to show you some of those ways now. One way you can divide up bonds are what are called the mortgage bonds. They are backed by stuff. Backed by buildings, backed by this, there. And then the ones that are unsecured are called debentures. Those, they don't have anything that they attach to. They're just like sort of like general. It's the difference between having a home loan and having a credit card. The home loan would be a mortgage bond you had issued. The credit card would be a debenture you issued. And the debentures are, of course, going to be riskier than the mortgage bonds. They're obviously, because they're just sort of diffuse. Yes, you have prior claim over the stockholders, but you don't have prior claim and you can't point to something. A quick one that you might run into, well, I mean, in business, there's all kinds of different weird things that go on as far as securities go. But one thing that is interesting, there is a kind of mortgage bond, or actually sometimes a mortgage note, it's more likely to be. They're called ETCs. They are just a mortgage instrument, except that we call them ETCs because they are loans backed by physical equipment. You would get an ETC on, like, your truck fleet, an ETC on a crane. You get an ETC on some of the forklifts and things like that. Banks do these. They're sort of like a special, very standardized package deal. Banks will take care of ETCs. Okay, we're going to expand. We need 18 new trucks. Okay, what will happen is that there will be an ETC set up. The company will issue the ETC. A bank consortium or a commercial bank will buy that ETC. That will be the loan, and then the trucks will be bought. That ETC will be backed by the trucks. So if the company goes belly up, the bank gets those trucks. The bank gets those trucks. They're really just a mortgage bond or a mortgage note, but we call them this because they are specifically a market for these kinds of equipment trust certificates. I had heard of them when I was in college, but I actually ran into a real-life one when I started doing oil and gas exploration with these guys down in Texas. They just needed a rig to punch a hole. Well, we punched maybe six, but they didn't rent it. They wanted to buy it because the operation was getting large enough that they figured they needed an actual drilling rig. And so they actually just called up the bank that had been financing projects and working with these guys, and it was just a very quick, within like 6 hours, they said, this is where we're going to buy it, this is the price of it, and the ETC was set up, signed, and we had the rig and the roughnecks out within like 72 hours. So, I mean, that was where I first saw them, and they are very fast. The market is so complete and they're so common that banks know exactly what to do and companies know exactly what they're called and all that kind of stuff. And it's a very smooth
deal that happens. There are even brokers in ETCs. Oh, you need equipment, I'll set it up with this bank, and then blah, 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 for a fee. Okay, that's one way that you can look at it. Now, another thing that can weigh, and there are so many different flavors and types and oddballs of bonds, but one that is quite pretty common is what's called a callable bond. A callable bond, and by the way, if you're buying bonds, you'll see a little C next to the bond. That's callable. A callable bond gives the borrower, the issuer, the right but not the obligation, the right but not the obligation to pay off the bond before the maturity. The right but not the obligation to pay off the bond before the maturity. We say the company can call the bond. You would see one, FTL, 6.7%, 2037. Callable in 2030. In other words, this company has borrowed money. The bondholders will get 6.7% coupon annually into installments. And they will are anticipating that they will get to the, get that until 2037. However, starting in 2030, this company could actually pay off those bonds. Now, probably the reason they would do it is because interest rates had fallen and they could reissue with a lower coupon. But they are callable, which means that the investors are at a disadvantage. To the extent that if I'm an investor, I've lent this company money, I am expecting that until 2037, I will get $67 a year. In 2031, let's say, interest rates have fallen. Well, I'm safe. I'm getting 6.7%. No, because this is a callable bond, the bond, the company could say, we're going to pay off your, here's your $1,000, have a good day. That's what a callable bond does. Now, yeah.
So they don't pay any of the extra 6 years or whatever interest?
Nope, it's over. Game over. Done. Actually, almost every one of you is going to issue a callable bond or probably a number of callable bonds in your life because you can pay off your mortgage early. That's a callable bond. You issued a callable bond. You can refi, call in the bond. Just pay off the bank and borrow the money from another bank. Your car loan is callable. You can pay it off whenever you want. You can pay. Your student loan is callable. They're all callable loans. And when they're callable, that is adverse to the interests of the lender, which means that the lender is going to ding you for that privilege you have on them. In fact, interestingly enough, I'm not sure. I thought I said this in an earlier lecture. When you take out a mortgage loan, when you sign that paper, there is actually fine print that says, if you pay this off early, we're going to charge you money to do that. They call it points if you pay off the loan early. And usually that those points are assessed on a declining basis. If you pay off in the first 5 years, we whack you with a bunch of points. They're like basis points on the balance. Oh, if you pay off the loan between this time year, this it's a little less. And after 20 years, we don't care whether you call it or not. We don't charge points. So, in other words, there's oftentimes a smack in the face for a call on it. I found out that the last car loan I had,
actually had a penalty fee for paying off the loan. I think it was in the first 2 years. There was a penalty. It was a rather stiff penalty. It was like, what was it? It was like 10% of the remaining balance on the loan. So callability is adverse to the lender, and sometimes lenders will spank the company for this. Watch this. Let's try this. Suppose that the price of this bond is $120.50. This is the price of the bond. Now I'm going to show you something here. We'll get the yield to maturity first. We'll get the yield to maturity first. Really turns off on me. Okay. Okay, so on this bond, what was that? A 2037. So, whoops, I didn't mean to do that. Okay. 2037 0. Really? What is it with those weird trig things that they put in there? Okay, now in this case, 2037, that's 20 years out, 20 times 2. 20 times 2. Drop it back down. We're going to find the yield. The present price value is negative $1,020.50. The payments on this one are $67 a year divided into two installments. Now, let's go back up here and have a look. Get the yield to maturity, alpha solve, and then times that by two. Times two. 6.52%. Now, the next thing I'm going to do is get what's called the yield to call. In other words, we do the same calculation, but we assume that the bond will be called immediately at the first available time. So in this case, at 2030, it's 13 years times 2. Everything else is the same, and I'm just going to get the yield to call, alpha solve. And then I'll run over times 2. 6.46%. So the yield to call is dinging me as an investor. I'm not getting what I want. The yield to call, this is a contingent yield. In other words, in the event that the company calls at its first opportunity, this is all I'm going to earn. If the company rides it to the end, I'm getting a market rate of 6.52%. But if this thing doesn't ride out, if the company exercises its call option, then I am going to get less than that. The yield to call, all you do is change the term from the maturity to the call. That's all you do. Everything else stays the same. So if you're asked for a yield to call, it's a very simple calculation. Here's another flavor, a bond that is convertible, a convertible bond. A convertible bond gives the company the right, but not the obligation, to turn your debt that you are owed into stock in the company. I got a coupon payment coming up to you. Man, I can't pay it. You're going to take me to court. You're going to close my company down.
You're gonna ruin my dreams. Oh, wait a minute. I've got a convertibility. Oh, here's some stock. Your debt's cleared. Here's some stock in my company. Now, let me tell you, I'll ask you, is that going to make you happy? Oh, gee, I'm now an owner of a company that couldn't pay me my bill. Do you see what that is? That is definitely not a good thing. We'll invest in them as long as we can get them at cheap prices, but these things are nasty because if the company is turning your debt into equity, it means the company is all on its deathbed anyway. Like I said, the prices of bonds like that are going to be lower than normal bonds, simply because investors are just going to stay away from those until they're a bargain, because they're just plain kind of adverse. And I don't know. A lot of convertible bonds, there are some that have actually come back. They converted a lot of debt to equity, and then, the debt holders, they're not debt holders, so they can't liquidate the company. They're just sitting there like other owners, hoping to heaven that the company puts itself back together again. But, you know, they're out there. Convertible bonds. Just know that you're getting a really good price for them because they are a very risky instrument. High risk, low price, and all that good stuff. But and then there are other kinds of bonds, too, that are out there. Just all kinds of flavors of animals, little twists and turns on the typical bond instrument. But always know that your coupon is going to be based on risk. You're not going to get a bargain. If you get a great coupon, that means that there's low risk, so there's low... If you get a very high coupon, that means that there's a high risk. That means that company might not be able to pay you in the end. So always keep that in mind. And if you get a high grade, you want safety. Well, that's AAA, AA bonds. No doubt about it, they're safe. You're not going to get a great coupon on those kinds of bonds. Also, understand that the interest rates, bonds, just like everything else, are interest rate sensitive instruments. The shorter the time remaining, the lower the term, the less interest rate sensitive a bond gets. I mean, it makes sense. You have a bullwhip. Now, when you have that thing completely extended, and you are humming the music to Rawhide, roll 'em, roll 'em, roll 'em. Yeah, cut 'em in, move 'em out, whack. The end of that thing is going to just make, you know, that cow go. Ooh. But as you get closer and closer and hold on to a smaller and smaller piece, and then you try to do that to that bull to get him to move, he's going to say, "Really? Moo." Okay, so real examples for real people. The longer the term, the more a movement of interest rates of a given amount creates action on the bond. So if you're looking for interest rate play, you play long bonds. If you're not looking for interest rate play, you pull in shorter on your bonds. Okay, so if you're buying mutual funds that are bond oriented, the one thing you look at is the average maturity of the bond, the average term of the bonds. You'll see it right there. Mutual funds for bonds always say that. So you could say, all right, I've got this mutual fund, and I was just playing with one a while back. It had an average term of 2.7 years. And then there was another one that had an average term of like 14 years. Well, obviously, that bond mutual fund that has the longer term is going to be more sensitive to interest rates. I'll see more price action on it. The one that was closer in with a very short maturity, interest rates could go pretty crazy, and that thing will stay stable. So if you don't want interest rate sensitivity, you go with a portfolio that has shorter term bonds,
average. If you want to play those interest rates, well, then you would probably go with a longer term mutual fund. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.